You're listening to God, Law, and Liberty with David Fowler and Gary Humble. We're putting culture on a collision course with the truth.
All right, we're back with another episode of God, Law, and Liberty. And, you know, we're still continuing this discussion on authority, liberty. You know, last episode, if you tuned in, I encourage you to go, Apple Podcasts, we're on Google, Spotify, go check it out. But last episode, we were talking about rights, David, and kind of where rights come from and how rights shape our culture and even how rights sometimes can restrict our liberty in some ways. And now we have this group of Tennessee Independent Baptists who have filed this amicus brief that we want to get into today. And so we're continuing this conversation, and we keep referencing back to the statement by de Tocqueville, who said, if the lights that guide us ever go out, they will fade little by little, as if of their own accord. Confining ourselves to practice, we may lose sight of basic principles. And when these have been entirely forgotten, we may apply the methods derived from them badly. We might be left without the capacity to invent new methods, only to make a clumsy and unintelligent use of wise procedures that we no longer understand, which you've said fairly often is exactly where we are today. We have forgotten the original precepts and concepts that formed our Constitution.
Yeah. It goes back to our introduction to the podcast where you gave the little pigs analogy.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk about the three little pigs again.
But it's worth pointing out that what you were in essence saying is there's a foundation. And over time, we have we've built on them with sticks and straw and, you know, now it seems like whipping cream.
Right.
And so what de Tocqueville's saying is true. We read phrases and we interpret them in light of what we think they might mean that may have nothing to do with what they actually meant. And so we're doing what he says, which is to make a clumsy and unintelligent use of wise procedures because we don't know why those are really there. And one of the things we said about this podcast that I hope is if people listen, maybe if this is the first one they've listened to, let me encourage you, as you did at the top of the podcast, go back and listen to the first two issues about the question of authority. In every society, in every person's life, even, there has to be a principle of authority. What do we live by? And in the last episode, you had opened it up by saying, but where do we find space, given that there has to be authority? How do we find space for liberty? Mm-hmm. If everything's authority, that's tyranny. So we cry out today, liberty, liberty, liberty. We want liberty. The Supreme Court says you have liberty to have abortion. You have liberty to have marriages however you think they are defined. And liberty, liberty, liberty. Well, what is liberty? Where does it come from? What's the nature and the understanding of liberty? And we said we also want to not just have this be abstract, theological, metaphysical, philosophical conversations. Right. We want to...
How we live it out.
Yeah. How does this work itself out in the real world? Well, we got a classic example last week when an organization called the Tennessee Independent Baptist for Liberty filed an amicus brief in a lawsuit that actually our organization is handling that's in front of the Court of Appeals. So for listeners who don't know, our viewers who don't know, an amicus brief is the word we use in Latin for a friend of the court brief. So the Independent Baptist group has come in and said, hey, we want to be a friend of the court and give you a perspective on this issue that perhaps, you know, Fowler, on behalf of his clients, has not yet given you. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did. They've asked the court to accept the brief. And I want us to talk a little bit about that brief because it points out these unintelligible, clumsy uses of wise procedures. And it just now dawned on me, he was talking about it, I thought, isn't it interesting that the phrase, the separation of church and state, was written by Jefferson in response to Baptist in Connecticut.
Huh. Remember?
So now it really, the Baptist again, who have been so, consumed's not the right word, that would have had a negative, but have been so fierce. Are so steadfast in their concepts of liberty, of conscience, and independents, you know, the independent Baptists, they're not really a denomination. And so they actually formed this group not to create a denomination, but to say a lot of times our churches, you know, and they're literally, I think, 1,000 or more across the state of Tennessee.
Right.
Because we don't have a denominational head like the Southern Baptist or the Assembly of God or the Church of God. We don't have somebody that's gathering information, watching stuff at the Capitol, keeping us informed.
But they need to find a common voice on this issue.
But we need to know what's going on. Yeah. So they have filed here. So I think this is history repeating itself in our country. But there's a phrase in the Tennessee Constitution that I think would be dear to these Baptists, that ought to be dear to Presbyterians and Baptists and Lutherans and Anglicans and you name it. It ought to be dear to all of us. And it's the phrase, the liberty of conscience. And so you and I have had some discussions since the filing of that brief last week that
right.
I think have been really, really good. But that
I'm
phrase,
still trying to straighten it all out yeah. in my head.
Well, and I am too. Because I told you earlier, I would think of liberty of conscience, and this is what we would think of today, is that I'm free to believe what I want to believe. But that doesn't give me any freedom to practice it. So, for instance, in the Supreme Court's marriage decision, which is the context for this amicus brief, the Supreme Court said, you're free to believe and to speak anything you want about religion. But when your religious beliefs become enacted law and policy, that's their phrase. That's another story. Now, the reality is all law reflects some religious belief. We talked about that in our first episode.
Certainly.
Everybody has a view of God. But today, I'll bet you, if our listeners, or we could poll them, they'd say freedom of conscience means I get to believe what I want to believe. I have a freedom of speech about what I want to believe. But my ability to live that out is limited. So there's a phrase in the Tennessee Constitution that, to be honest, I'd never paid much attention to, and I don't know if you have it in front of you here, and you may not. I may not have given it to you, but it.
Article 1, Section 3.
Yeah, just read that real quickly. This is in the Tennessee Constitution.
Yeah, that all men have a natural and indefeasible right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience. That no man can of right be compelled to attend, erect, or support any place of worship, or to maintain any minister against his consent. That no human authority can, in any case whatever, control or interfere with the rights of conscience.
Yeah, read that last part again.
Yeah, that no human authority can, in any case whatever, control or interfere with the rights of conscience.
Yeah. So I'd never picked up on that phrase. To be honest, I'd never thought much about it. There are writers who would say the idea of no human authority can interfere or control with rights of conscience is what the framers intended by the First Amendment free exercise of religion
sure.
provision.
That would make sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. But so what does that mean? Okay, let's again go back to de Tocqueville, who says, do you really know why that's in there? Do you understand what it is trying to communicate and what it's protecting? Is it just protecting what Gary thinks in his head? Mm-hmm. Or is it protecting anything? Gary?
Probably not.
Some of the things maybe shouldn't be protected. But in any event, the phrase I realized, I went back, and while independent Baptists would certainly differ with Calvin in numerous respects regarding particularly salvation and effectual calling, those doctrines of predestination and election.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they would necessarily disagree with everything he said, just like a solid Presbyterian wouldn't disagree with everything a Baptist would say. And I remembered that in Calvin's Institutes, which were written in, I think it was the 1500s, but shortly after Luther, Calvin wrote, okay, after Luther's posting of the 95 Theses on the door. And Calvin had talked about the liberty of conscience in the his Institutes of the Christian Religion. And I may have given you that phrase or highlighted a phrase or two that I don't know if you want to try to read it in there. But
got a Westminster Confession.
Okay. Well, I may not have given you what Calvin said, but he talks about the human authority and the liberty of conscience. Okay? So that's in the 1500s. Along comes the Westminster Confession, and the Westminster Confession speaks again of liberty of conscience. And I think they maybe even use the word human authority too. I don't remember. But a lot of people don't know what the Westminster Confession is, and this is just a little bit of history. I hope that's fascinating. But the Westminster Confession, we identify primarily with the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah.
Okay, because they were the Puritans that pulled it together, the Puritan divines. But they were pulled together by the Parliament. Now, that's an odd thing. Can you imagine the Tennessee legislature or Congress passing a resolution and we say, we want the brightest minds on Christian theology to come together and develop for us a set of beliefs and statements in creedal form by which those of us who govern, the king, which of course was the head of the church there, so it made a little sense, can know how to govern people.
Yeah, and we ask all the pastors to write it?
Yeah.
Oh, they go nuts.
When they go nuts. But that's what they did. They pulled together the Puritan divines. That's what they were called, not because they were divine in nature, but you know, they were esteemed as ministers and theologians. And for 3-5 years, I think maybe it was 5 years, they hammered out these documents. Okay? Now, the Church of England and the King sort of accepted it. Scotland really took it. And they had a tremendous reformation in Scotland that didn't go quite as far in England. But so the Westminster Confessions, we need to understand, was actually a document that is completely theological, that was pulled together by the government at the request of the government.
And just this piece of it, I'm looking at. So you gave me chapter 20.
Right.
And in part two of that, it says, God alone is the Lord of the conscience and has left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men, which are in anything contrary to his word.
Yes. And then it says, and besides, it goes on and makes another statement.
Yeah, or beside it, matters of faith or words, so that to believe such doctrines or to obey such commands out of conscience is to betray true liberty of conscience.
Yes, yeah. So notice what they said there. They said any commandment that violates conscience, and beside that, those on worship, mm-hmm. right? So where do we get commandments? We get commandments from the church regarding the sacraments and so on and so forth and moral duties, let's say. But we also get commandments from the government.
From the government,
right. And so these pastors in their bylaws, when I read them, I went, wow, this is what started me down this path of the Tennessee Constitution. So as listeners listen and they think, oh, you've studied for years or whatever else it is. No, I've studied for about 2 weeks, you know, as I read what was in their bylaws. But here's what they say in their bylaws. That they make a statement in here about the power of the civil government, okay, and they make a statement about conscience. So why don't you shuffle some papers maybe and pretend you're having a sip of coffee or something, and I thought I'd pull this up.
While you're pulling it up, you know, one of the things too we want to get into, you just mentioned this idea that we receive commandments, you know, both from the Lord, so mm-hmm. so our church ordinances, if you right. will, and from government. So we have these spheres, mm-hmm. you know, of society, these spheres that we have that we obey that are both at the end of the day, their authority is from God,
right?
There's nothing else above that authority. The only authority above the church is God, and we could also infer that the only authority above the government is God.
That's right. That's right.
Or nothing, I guess, to some people.
But. Yeah, or nothing. But here's what they said in their bylaws. Now, what you just read about the Westminster Confession,
right?
About binding the conscience. God's the God of conscience and human authority. They had a statement in their bylaws that's quoted in their motion here. Civil government is of divine appointment for the interest and good order of human society. The government officials are to be prayed for, conscientiously honored and obeyed. So there's the matter of a conscience, because they have an authority that comes from God.
Wow.
Okay? Except in things opposed to the will of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is the Lord of conscience. And didn't they just make some statement exactly like that?
In that section 2, chapter 20. Yeah, God, in fact, it starts as God alone is the Lord of the conscience.
Yeah, there's where we get the phrase, okay? So now we're getting into a little something deeper here than I get to think something. So this question, as I began to look about the concept of conscience, and here's where I think it comes from what Calvin was talking about, Christian liberty, what the Westminster Divines say. And then there's another Reformed theologian of the late 1800s who became the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Abraham Kuyper.
Kuyper, yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk a lot about Kuyper. And he has a whole section in the lectures that he gave to the Princeton Seminary. Of course, today he would be canceled in our canceled culture. He could never even speak what he told. But he said, look, you need to understand what Calvin was saying here is that while Luther addressed problems between the church and humanistic thinking of the Renaissance, so we have to keep in mind the culture at the time of Luther, the church and the Renaissance humanistic thinking were getting blended together, and there were corruptions in the church. I'm not trying to speak of evil of the Catholic Church. There were
sure
things that were being influenced with humanistic thinking rather than biblical thinking, and so on and so forth. So Luther
not to talked, get into it, but we could say the same is happening
with the evangelical today. Church. Absolutely, right. Yeah. So the point in that is that Luther addressed the question of God's sovereignty from a soteriological salvation standpoint. God alone saves. He was in an Augustinian monk, a monastery. Augustine, you know, hundreds of years earlier, had said, man is depraved, he is fallen, and every part of him is fallen, and so his will is under bondage. He is a slave to sin. I cannot do what pleases God. My mind is hostile to God. It's at enmity with God. I never love God with all of my heart, soul, mind, and strength. Everything I do is not for the glory of God. So I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. I can't do it. So he asserted that. He wrote a book called The Bondage of the Will. Okay? But Calvin then comes along and he takes this principle of sovereignty in regard to salvation. Now that's where the Independent Baptist would sure would probably begin to quibble and say, where is man's free will come in and all that? But Calvin said, if God is sovereign, then he's sovereign over everything. If he's not sovereign over everything, he's really not sovereign. He's not God. He's something else. He's maybe really great, you know, but he's not God. That is what God is sovereign. And he said, so what began to happen in Calvin's view is that we no longer live before and through the church, and we're no longer completely under the government. So as you go into this medieval period here, the church rightly understood we should bring all things captive to Jesus Christ. The claims of Christ are global. Christianity's global. In that sense, we're no different from essentially every other religion, particularly Islam, you know. But the church was seen as really still that mediator between God and man. So you had to go through the church, and the church had to bring things under the auspices of the church because the church was still mediating between God and man. Calvin, and of course Luther before him, said, no, we live before the face of God, coram Deo. And that's an expression that comes out of the Reformation. If you take the Latin Vulgate Bible, which translated the whole Bible into Latin, and it's called the Vulgate, you'll find Old Testament scriptures and New Testament scriptures that use the phrase coram Deo, before God, the presence of God. And so Luther was saying, my relationship with God is immediate and direct. It's not through the king, who may be the head of the church and head of the government. It's not through the church. I live coram Deo, before the face of God.
Right.
Okay. And so,
according to my conscience.
According to my conscience, mm-hmm. to which I'm accountable. Okay, so what Calvin did is he took Luther the next step and said, if this is sovereignty, then sovereignty has to apply everywhere or it's not sovereignty. And he said, so here's what happened. And this is what Kuyper said, and I would encourage people to read it. It's a little hard to read. You have to get used to the way he wrote in the late 1800s, but it's intelligible. It's not that complicated. He said, look, here's the reality. What he was saying was, or Calvin was implying, and what has developed since then, as the Westminster Divines continued working out this theology and John Owens and other people, is that by 1898, he's saying, what Calvin was saying is, the church has a certain jurisdiction from God. Its authority, its power comes from God. Then the government and the state has a certain authority that comes from God. Kings are divine rulers. Don't let the king pollute the judgments. They're divine judgments. Romans 13, the magistrate is the minister of God. He doesn't bear the sword in vain. But they have been given a jurisdiction by God. And Kuyper took those thoughts and said, so there's this concept, and this is how he articulated it, of sphere sovereignty. Mm-hmm. There's the sphere of the church, and it has an authority directly from God for which it's accountable, and God alone is above the church. The government has an authority from God, and God alone is above the government and the state. But between these two jurisdictions, man stands in liberty of conscience before God, accountable to God. So when we start talking about liberty of conscience, I think that they're saying is there's this whole sphere of liberty where I am accountable to God. Now, I can't go kill people, you know, can't rape and maim people. I can't break the main commandments of murder and lying and theft, and the government should bear the sword not in vain.
Right.
But I realize where we're losing liberty is that today we sit here and say, I don't have the freedom anymore to live before God as to whether I bake a cake for your wedding or not. I don't have a liberty before God to decide whether or not to do much of anything anymore. Our founders... And Kuyper and the Westminster Puritan divines would all be horrified that, what do you mean? That's the freedom of association. Our Supreme Court's recognized that concept. Well, we don't really have it anymore. We have become as totalitarian as what our Protestant forebears brought us out of. To say, no. Well, here's the downside. If I don't make the government make you do something, then they may let you not do something to me. So I'm willing to enslave them so that I can enslave you. So you can, you see what
right,
I'm saying?
Right. And so what we get into there
is... We have no liberty of conscience before God anymore without violating the commands of man.
Right. And so let's transition a little bit with that into this idea of the organic versus the mechanical.
Okay, but let me kind of go back to the minister here just a moment.
Okay.
So what they're saying about marriage, I think, now I'm translating for them, but as I read this and thought of this liberty of conscience, is they're saying, wait a minute, I'm a minister of God. I live before the face of God. My parishioners live before the face of God. Under the old common law concept of marriage, and we'll talk more about common law all throughout this thing.
Sure, yeah.
The idea was men and women marry. Marriage is not created by the government. What's now happened is the government says, we've created marriage. The Supreme Court has mandated a marriage. And now you're telling me as a minister before God that when I oversee and officiate a Christian marriage, for the law to recognize it, for the law to give security to the rights and the obligations that that couple undertake as man and wife, I have to sign a marriage license and a certificate from the state that defines marriage contrary to God's law. You have violated and interfered with and are trying to control my conscience before God by your unrighteous command.
Yeah.
Government has taken over marriage, which was a thing between the man and the woman and their in the Catholic Church and the priest and before God. And said, no, you now bow down to me. Your marriage is not going to be recognized. We will not secure to you the rights of marriage unless somebody signs a godless form. And I don't care if you're a preacher. I don't care if you're an elected official. Somebody's got to sign a form that defines marriage contrary to God. And our framers would say, I will not sign that. I think the Danbury Baptist Association in Connecticut would have said that to Thomas Jefferson. Are you going to ever support a Supreme Court that makes me sign a document that marriage is a relationship defined without regard to sex? You see, that's what these Baptists are saying. They're raising a critical, huge issue. And because we don't understand what liberty of conscience was and its context and why it arose, we're making a clumsy use of it. And we say, well, you're free to believe that about marriage if you want to, but you have to sign that form. You see? So anyway, I think that's important to draw that conclusion as to what they're really trying to say here. And so all this stuff we're talking about has a real life today present meaning.
Yeah, absolutely. But it also comes out of the you know, again, this idea of what is organic, you know, what is, you know, what our consciences follow simply because it's just what we've always known to be versus what we mechanically create as the state.
Right.
And so I love some of this from, you know, specifically regarding marriage, you know, back to this issue that at hand.
Now, this is who?
This is Kuyper. So Kuyper's writings.
Okay.
He said, it is here of the highest importance, sharply in mind, the difference in grade between the organic life of society and the mechanical character of government. Whatever among men originates directly from creation mm-hmm. is possessed of all the data for its development. In human nature as such, you see this at once in the family and in connection of blood relations and other ties. From the duality of man and woman, marriage arises. From the original existence of one man and one woman, monogamy comes forth. The children exist by reason of the innate power of reproduction. Naturally, the children are connected as brothers and sisters. And when by and by these children in their turn marry again, as a matter of course, all those connections originate from blood relationship and other ties, which dominate the whole family life. In all this, there is nothing mechanical. Hmm. So just the idea that, you know, we've lost the ability to recognize, specifically speaking in marriage, and even understanding, you know, what makes a man and a woman. It's amazing how we've lost the ability to recognize just what is organic and arises out of just natural activity. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one man and one woman, and of course that informed us of the marriage relationship. They came together, they had kids. Mm-hmm. All of those kids feel a natural connection with their mom, with their dad. Mm-hmm. They feel a natural connection with their siblings, with their brothers and sisters, and we talk about you know, blood is thicker than water, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know? That's right.
Blood relations, and we have cousins, and we have nephews and nieces because we're blood related because of those familial ties that we have and naturally, organically.
And there are certain natural rights or obligations associated with
it. Right, that have been naturally created, that the court and governments did not have to manufacture or create. They simply exist because it's just the way humankind
is. It's how life works.
It's how life works.
It's how we live before the face of God.
Right.
So I've often asked people, I said, for example, if you didn't have a birth certificate for your three boys, would you be the father of their children? You would look at me like I'm stupid to suggest you're not. Of course you're the parent of the birth certificates aside. Now, you go run off and abandon your wife and your three kids, would you expect the civil government through its judicial system to come in and say, hey, Gary, wait a minute. You need to feed and clothe those kids. Well, you would expect them to. You would say the law is wrong if it doesn't. Do they only do that because, well, we got a birth certificate here. I guess you need to take care of them. They'd say, I don't care whether you got a birth certificate or not. That's why we have paternity statutes. We have child support apart from marriage.
Right.
Okay. There are natural things that arise.
You made some kids.
You have to take care of them. That's a natural obligation. It's a part of the creational law. It has its own organic life before the face of God. And if there wasn't a government to enforce your child support, you would be under, at least before God, a moral duty to take care of them. But now you mentioned mechanical. And even as you were saying this, I thought, because I read this thing from Kuyper, I don't know, 20 years ago, and I continue to read it periodically. But I'll bet you if he was sitting here today, he would say, well, what I meant by mechanical is what today you mean by positive law.
Mm, yes, of course.
That it's created, and in that sense, it's mechanical. It's not natural. It's not organic. It's not a part of the nature of things.
Right.
See? So these pastors, I think, in this amicus brief are saying, and I can't speak for them. I'm not their attorney, but I would say if I ask them, are you saying marriage is a part of the creational law, the natural law, or it's a part of the warp and woof of how things are, that it arises naturally? And so the government, their first duty is to secure the rights that we naturally have living before the face of God. And so what has happened is government has come in with a mechanical law, a positive law, and said, no, marriage can only now be done this way. You don't live before the face of God. You live before the United States Supreme Court. We define marriage this way. And for your ministry to give effect to a marriage that would be legally recognized, or for your rights as a husband or wife to be secured, you have to sign a form and you have to say, he's the Lord of conscience. I will not bow down and sign that form. So we sit here and we wring our hands about the Supreme Court. And what if every godly official who can sign a marriage license, county commissioner, governor, legislator, minister, said, before the face of God, I cannot bring into existence by mechanical means a relationship the mechanical positive law defines contrary to God's law. I will not do that. I will not bow down to that. Throw me in the furnace if you have to, but I will not bow down. We would take care of the Obergefell decision and same-sex marriage just by our obedience of conscience living before the face of God.
Right.
That we don't do that and we haven't done that, I don't know. I'd almost say it's a condemnation of the church.
That's about three more podcasts right there on how I feel about how the church has basically just shirked its responsibility and completely abdicated its responsibility to be the conscience of the government. I mean, who else is the are we depending on the government to create our conscience?
Yeah.
And so this idea is just, the more I think about this, how in order to go along with same-sex marriage and abortion and all of these things that just so intrinsically go against the nature of things and how things were created and how we look at bloodlines and familial ties and just things that feel and seem natural to us, which is where we derive our conscience somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
The law is creating these mechanical things in order to redefine what our conscience should be.
Mm.
It's crazy.
Yeah, in Romans it talks about that those without the law have a law written on their heart, and it either accuses them or confirms them in what they're doing. And our conscience God gave to us, and it's fouled because of sin, let's say, that's what the Bible says. It's fouled. But still, our conscience speaks to us. And so we have to suppress the truth in our unrighteousness.
Right.
To say, well, I really ought not to have to care for those kids because if she had been taking the pill regularly, or if something else happened, I wouldn't have those kids. Or she could have aborted those children. So it's not my fault, that she can't afford to feed them and clothe them and house them. I told her she should have had an abortion. So we come up with reasons. I've often told people, I said, every time you give a reason for why you shouldn't have to do something, you are affirming the existence of a transcendent law. By your excuse, you're saying, I know this law is true, but I have an exception.
Mm-hmm.
So let me share a little conversation. I had a group of Jewish women, liberal in their politics, came to see me. I think it was in 2005. I left the legislature in 06. At the time, I was carrying the resolution to the Tennessee Constitution saying there's no right to abortion in the state constitution. The women came in and said, we respect and appreciate your religious views, but we don't think you should allow them to interfere with and determine public policy. And I said, well, I usually don't talk about my religion on the Senate floor and as the basis for the, but I said, so I'm happy to do that. We'll not talk about that. Let me ask you what it is we're aborting. Once we know what it is we're aborting, then we can discuss the ethics of the procedure. So I said, what are we aborting? So to make a 30-minute conversation short, they said it's a potential life. And I said, okay, I need to understand what you mean by potential life. I said, and this is literally true what
it's
I said.
The whole viability argument.
So I said to them, look, here's what I need to understand. So what you're saying is, even though in every instance throughout the known annals of history that a woman who got pregnant delivered a baby, there is the possibility that it could be a fish or a cat or a dog. I mean, literally, I said that. Or a dog, that there's some point where it goes from potentially being a human to actually being a human. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, of course we don't mean that. And I said, no, I'm being serious. I'm trying to understand this word. And they said, well, according to the Talmud, until the baby is quickened. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. You came in here and said, do not rely on your religion. And I said, I wouldn't. But now you have resorted to your religion to define when this, what it means to be potentially human.
Right.
And I said, so if you can use your religion, I can use mine. But let me tell you what the problem is right here. We all know that it is wrong to kill another innocent human being. So you have to find an exception to the rule. And by finding the exception, you testify to the rule.
And law really doesn't need to be a mechanical thing for us. It's something we kind of just know.
We know that. Yeah. We have to suppress the truth in our unrighteousness, and we do it all the time. So what's now happened, as sonograms became available, and we could look and say, that looks like a baby, and it's sucking its finger, and it's got the hiccups. Dr. Brent Bowles, a good friend of this ministry, just posted something on Facebook last week, this week, of a sonogram of a 12-week-old that had the hiccups. Mm. You know, clumps of cells don't get hiccups. So what we had to do is that they could no longer suppress the truth that this is a human being and a human life because the pictures told us it wasn't. So consequently, the babies are now, we're even seeing in the word, they're trespassers. Well, of course, trespassers are wrongdoers, right? So, or we have to couch it as healthcare. We can't use the word have a right to abort the fetus because everybody says, I think that actually that's the Latin word for little baby or little one or, you know, and the pictures prove that. So now it's healthcare. Now it's about trespassing. Now it's about interfering. The baby's a wrongdoer. It's an intruder. You see how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say in all of this, because people can hear us talk about abortion, especially same-sex marriage. And, you know, of course, I know you've been here many times. Oh, it's bigots and these guys are hateful and this and that. And speaking specifically of liberty, I just want to say, you know, if the government, because again, we talk about what we know is that this, what we just talked about being organic, it's obvious that if a man and a woman come together, they have a child, that a family has been created, that no one disputes that, right? But if the government, in terms of liberty, if the government can come along and take what is absolutely natural and organic and now forcibly redefine and cause it to now be something mechanical.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. Yeah.
Then they can do that if we give government the power to do that. Uh-huh. If we in one instance give the government the power to take what is organic and make it now mechanical.
Positive law.
They can do that to anything.
They can do it to anything, but they have to, here's the other kick. They have to do it, to be consistent, to everything now related to marriage, flowing out of marriage in the family.
Which people haven't quite grasped.
Right. So consequently, you would say when you went into a court, let's make
the parent and child relationship is now
mechanical and positive. That's right. And why does it have to be? Because if you're going to say the relationship you and Andrea have and Linda and I have is equal to the one Sally and Susie have or Bob and Fred have.
Right.
And then children are introduced into it. How are they introduced? Mechanically, non-naturally.
Right.
Now, I would say it's still natural. You still have to have a male and a female. But as between there being two parents, the actual
from second, the legal aspect.
From the natural standpoint, the second parent is gone. There's
right.
no surrogate anymore. There's no male sperm donor. So to make those equal, the Supreme Court has already said since Obergefell, I think it was 2 years later in 2017, you have to treat two women as both mothers on a birth certificate. Well, that's lying to people. That's lying to the child. It's lying to the public. A child does not have two mothers unless mother is now a mechanical positive law concept. But now here comes the problem. A couple goes in Ohio, says, our 17-year-old daughter wants to become a boy, or vice versa. This is a true case, whichever it was. I don't remember, but we'll say that I think their son wanted to become a girl. Parents said, we're not going to consent to that. You're a minor. I'm your parent. You can't do it. So they get a lawyer. Excuse me. The girl gets a lawyer, goes to the court, and says, I have a right to express my identity. That's the very first sentence of Obergefell. The Constitution gives you liberty to define and express your identity. My grandparents are willing to let me start the hormone therapy. My parents won't. So what did the court do? The court said, you have no natural rights as to the nurturing and raising and inculcating of values into your daughter. She's 17. She gets to decide how she wants to identify. So we're removing custody from the parent and giving it to the grandparents. People were outraged by that, but did they understand? Well, of course, that's the natural result. That's the right result.
That's what Obergefell created.
Yes.
That's what it set precedent for.
Why are you shocked?
Yeah.
Of course, parental rights don't exist in the natural. They can't exist because Susie and Sally can never have the same kind of rights as to their children as David and Linda could have because ours arise naturally. Theirs can't arise naturally, not as to both of them. So to make them equal, yours have to be mechanical positive law.
Right.
That's why I wrote an article, 3 years ago, will parents soon have to be licensed? People go, that's Orwellian. Okay. Just wait. Pull it out someday. You're losing custody because you're doing something the state thinks is wrong for this individual who has autonomy. And so when does this kick in? At 16? It was 17. What about 16? What about 15? What about 14? What about when you're 7 or 8? Yep. Should we have a guardian ad litem appointed for the 7-year-old? We just read about that with who was the young boy
James
in Texas?
Younger.
Yeah, James Younger. His mother says, he's a girl. His father says, no, he's a boy. Around me, he's a fine.
By the way, that's such an interesting case because since all this has come out, we've got video testimony now of the boy who's now, his father has regained custodial rights. And the boy is now going to school. And he chooses going to school to identify as a boy. Mm-hmm. That's his choice now.
Yeah.
Well, his mom is still making this argument, and she's appealed, and she's trying to get the judge who made the ruling recused from the case. It's just crazy. I'm getting off on a tangent, but I
need to pick it up in the next podcast.
I'm dumbfounded on where we are today and how we try to mechanically create all of these relationships and how, again, my frustration with people in the church who are unwilling to acknowledge the dangers that we sit idly by and watch them progress.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the ideas that are changing the world.
And like we mentioned earlier, we talked about how what was it you said the Westminster Confession was adopted into what?
Well, it was requested by the Parliament.
Right.
Yeah. They said we need something to help us understand the relationship between church, state, the individual, and that's where the Westminster Confession came
from. The basis of every law that we have is rooted in God's truth. And as we continue to attempt to remove God's truth from our society, it would stand to reason that we no longer understand our laws and are now forced to recreate everything.
Yeah.
What a dangerous place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. As de Tocqueville said, as you said at the top of the show, we're left making clumsy and unintelligible uses of wise procedures because we don't know.
No longer understand them.
Wow, good show. In my opinion.
God help us.
Yes, amen.
All right, see you next time.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you want to help spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe too. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts. God, Law, and Liberty is a podcast of the Family Action Council of Tennessee. We are a 100% supporter-funded nonprofit advocating for family, life, marriage, and religious liberty. For more information, please visit us at www.factennessee.org. That's FACTennessee.org. And please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FACTennessee.